we've been through, in my career in the ETF industry, we've been through a handful of what I would call systemic breaks, places where we figured out where the cracks were in the system. You know, flash crash in 2010, the big obvious one. We changed a bunch of rules, haven't had a flash crash since. We, you know, stuff about how we were going to open and close illiquid bonds. Okay, we fixed some of that. Now we haven't had any of those problems, right? Orange County, you know, debt. We haven't had any of those problems. So we patched the ETF ecosystem as we've gone. The thing that we've now introduced that we have not tested is all of this leverage coming at through the almost exclusively through the options market is where that leverage is really coming from. On single securities, which we all know single securities have all sorts of issues of their own in terms of how they're going to get stopped, how they're going to get traded, how they're going to get manipulated. I'm, you know, I hate to be one of these people who's like, I have concerns, but I'm not going to tell you how to fix it. But I have concerns about the amount of leverage and particularly the amount of vega, the amount of volatility being bought and warehoused in the options market, given that the options clearing corporation's like emergency fund is like $200 million or something like that, which sounds like a lot of money until you realize the trillions of dollars of notional exposure.
Well, and in Canada, the problem is potentially more acute because it's an oligopoly. Canada will take certain positions in certain areas. Like our speculation is it hasn't been the double Tesla. It's been the Tesla with covered writing that yields 25%.
Yeah.
That's what's been popular in Canada. Canada loves covered writing, loves income, doesn't understand that.
Started the covered downside. You guys had those income products like 5 years before they got on here.
Right? Of course.
Let's get into it.
Well, you know, ironically, you know, like I just want to remind you that Canada was the innovator of the ETF, right?
You don't need to tell me, man. I am 100% no.
So it stands to reason that we should lead in some areas, you know, like where we're terrific. Like we've got terrific companies in Canada that are like the most expert consolidators of businesses like Couche-Tard. Like when I saw the news, I remember a few years ago that Couche-Tard was going to, and this is completely on tangent, but I just remember the news that Couche-Tard was going to buy Carrefour. And, you know, that they tried. The France, you know, nixed the deal, but they tried to buy Carrefour. And I thought, man, these, you know, this is Circle K. This is Max Milk. But, you know, they've just turned the gas station business into this behemoth. My point was that Canadian companies are really good at finding this edge and then dominating it.
No, I like if I'm a betting person on who gets the better side of the U.S.-Canadian trade war, I actually think Canada probably gets the better side of it because we're just only going to care about optics, right? And you guys will actually negotiate something that makes sense for you.
Oh no, we're optics now too.
Yeah,
well, you should see the way we're spinning.
Oh no, I read.
I'm like, guys, hey, listen, guys, because
but the same token, like it big seems brother, like your whole left small brother. Been upended by this, at least what I read in the press, right? That, you know, you've got the liberals who actually have a chance for the first time thanks to Trump. Like it seems like that. I don't know.
The polls still say super majority for conservatives.
I know, the Atlantic was talking about it this morning. Oh, that's all I know.
It's crazy, Tom. I feel like I don't even want to watch CNN anymore. I don't want to watch.
Oh God,
I don't want to watch. I mean, I don't want to watch. I almost don't want to watch any more news because it's the, you know, every day is another year of news. Every day is this, you know, this complete upending of everything that we know, and it's been like I think it's been surreal. It's and
intentionally so. Yeah, I mean that's the point.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask me just in casual conversations, you know, why, you know, and you hear it every day. Why are they doing this? Like, why is Trump doing this? Why is this Musk? Why? What's this Doge thing? Like, what's going on there? And the answer finally concluded that, you know, why the chaos? And that is the reason.
It's just the accumulation of raw power through obfuscation, right? I mean,
yeah,
you know, make so much noise that meanwhile, you know, quietly in the back corners, you know, $500 million contracts are going out to do things that we used to have employees do, right? So in a year or two from now, we will have not shrunk our government at all, but we will have moved 35% of our expenditures into the private sector. That's the goal. mean, we can get into this if you want. It's actually part of my core thesis on what advisors should be worried about.
Yeah, definitely you want to get into your core thesis.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Nadig is here, longtime friend and longtime friend of the show. Dave needs little or no introduction.
He has a long, well-known history in and around the financial business, in particular, his love of ETFs and all they stand for. We've got a lot to talk about today. We should just get started.
Awesome. Can I object to your introduction already? I mean, all they stand for? ETFs and all they stand for? I think maybe we can start there.
I remember the first time that we met at Inside ETFs Canada. Mm-hmm. And it was also the first time we did like a live recording at a conference.
And I remember that.
And you and Matt Hogan were so enthusiastic and so gracious and so much fun. Like you just like, you kicked it off for us. Like we, you know, from that moment on, it was like, wow, this is great. We have to do this more and more. Like this is an incredible opportunity. And what a great couple of guys, what an incredible energy they bring. But anyways,
I will tell you that is reflective. That wasn't coming from us. I still get excited about the Canadian ETF market, frankly, because you remain like the star nebula that, you know, the star nursery nebula that just spits out innovation into the rest of the world. I mean, half of everything interesting and good that's come out of the ETF market and frankly, out of packaged financial regulation for the last 40 years has largely started in Canada, maybe worked out a few kinks, and then that sort of promulgated around the rest of the world. You know, whether that's been, the very first ETFs, which were Canadian, or the very first, I mean, I could give you a list, fixed income ETFs, options-oriented ETFs, crypto ETFs. I mean, y'all are almost always there first. I always love looking at what y'all are doing in that market, because I think it really is the canary in the coal mine. And so if I look at the Canadian market now, what I see is a lot of the same stuff we're seeing in the US, although with less of the truly insane stuff, but only, I mean, you know, if you're comparing crazy people, how do you know which one's crazier, right? But you know, where in the US, I think we've gotten a little bit more addicted to the front end of the leverage, the most you only live once financial nihilistic type products that are really just gambling. You all seem to be taking similar structures and focusing much more on things like income, which you traditionally always have. And you know, when I've been looking at flows, I think there is a repatriation that's going to go on. I think it's clear from some of the numbers that some Canadian investors are going to start thinking Canada first on some of their portfolio decisions, even more than they might otherwise.
Interesting. And so, Dave, you've got a particularly interesting point of view these days because you're, truly independent.
That's a nice way of saying unemployed, but I appreciate that.
However we want to talk about it. But before we roll into that,
highly employable.
Highly employable. But where can people find you so that as we're going through, we'll go through this at the end too. But you've got it's a Substack that you're running. You've got some other stuff. So where can people find you, and then let's dig into some of your content.
Easiest thing is nadig.com, nadig.com. I've had that address since 1989, I think, which was the first time I could get it. I used to pay $200 a year for it, if you can imagine that. Now I think I've paid $200 until I die.
Deflation.
So I write a Substack there. I'm doing some podcasting work with the guys over at Excess Returns. I'll be on a show or two over there. If you know those guys, Jack Flynn, right, Matt Ziegler, Justin Carboneau, great group of guys. And primarily that's it. And then I'm working with a handful of what I would consider white hat ETF companies and some financial advisors, help them think about marketing, positioning, product methodology, those kinds of things. And that's kind of it. And I make a lot of zines. That's it.
Nice. I love you bringing back the zines. Speaking of white hat, black hat, you've got your recent article, Trust in the Black Hat World. We were going to chat a bit more about that. Maybe dig into that piece a little bit and give us a lay of the land and maybe we can pull a few threads, push back and think through all the things you're saying in that article.
Sure. So like really two independent threads that come together to lead me to be pretty pardon the pun, black and white about how I'm seeing the ETF industry and frankly, the investment markets overall. The first one is the erosion of institutional trust. All by itself, that is a thing that will change markets and how we interact with them. Was already something that was happening. I think pre-pandemic, people were talking about the decay of trust in Western societies. Definitely a, you know, not an original idea. What's different now is that there's reason, there's genuine reason to question the rule of law when it comes to investing. And I don't mean in some sort of really egregious tanks rolling across the border to Canada kind of rule of law. I'm talking about much subtler things that advisors actually should be worried about. So for instance, you have a client who's in a fund and that fund turns out to be fraudulent for some reason. And I'm not saying happens all the time, but it certainly happened several times in my lifetime. You would expect that the organs of state would now come and help you recapture stuff from that fraud, prosecute that fraud, et cetera. I think it's reasonable to suspect that will not be done with the vigor it might have been done 10 years ago going forward, particularly when we have, you know, the sitting president of the United States breaking securities laws in his own company to pre-announce products clearly against the both the letter and spirit of U.S. securities law. So nobody's going to come protect you when you fall for something like this, because increasingly it's going to be the government that's on the other side of these somewhat questionable kinds of scams, investments, whatever you want to say. So put that to one side, which is, okay, who can you trust? That's an issue. At the same time, the concentration of the U.S. ETF industry in particular and the race for the bottom in terms of providing cheap beta exposure, which is frankly what most of us need for anything, is just, you know, give me 5 basis points of global equities, I'm happy, right? I don't need all the rest of this stuff. That's that space is all gone. There's no room for a new player to come in with 5 basis point EFA or anything like that. So consequently, the only thing that they're leaning into is retail, and they're leaning into the worst retail. They're leaning into retail that is fundamentally gambling. It's, you can put the ads right alongside the sports books. It's the same people. It's the same trades. It's the same phone. It's just a different app, whether you're trading triple leveraged MicroStrategy or betting on the Steelers game. And so that's what those two things have happened at the same time in the ETF industry. And I think what that means is you can very clearly draw a line in the sand and pick which partners you want to work with. There are partners out there who are very obviously just throwing spaghetti at the wall, launching anything they can to get the maximum revenue in the shortest amount of time. And there are folks out there building thoughtful products that advisors could actually use in long-term portfolio management and rational risk management. But I don't think there's much gray area in the middle. And I think as advisors, investors, it's such a chaotic world right now. You can't turn on the news for more than 5 minutes without getting 10 years worth of news. You got to have some filters. And I think filtering your partners into the black hats and the white hats is a really useful way of minimizing how much interaction you need to have with chaos.
So that's interesting, Dave. I think, you know, the dichotomy that you're talking about, there's all the, you know, there's the well-heeled investors who have benefited from the last 15 years of, you know, rising markets, falling yields in bonds. And now, of course, we've got this regime change that's fomenting. And then on the other side, you've got those who are late to the party and prone to the speculation of having missed out the FOMO, you know, that's happening right now because markets are at all-time highs. So the first group, the first cohort that I mentioned, the well-heeled, long-time investor that has benefited immensely from you know, the market, is looking very carefully at, you know, examining how can I protect this largesse that I've earned in the market, and how can I make, you know, make sure I keep it. And that's always been the world of the high net worth investor, which is, you know, I've got this money. I you know, I had an event, I sold it, I made money in the market. I want to keep it. I want to make sure I have a legacy to pass forward to my kids, my family. And then the other side, so you have this on one side is the white hat side, where people are actually looking to protect and preserve and grow and continue to grow, of course, but to preserve and protect. And on the black hat prone side, you have the you know, as I think you put it, as the app wielding
the app trading, app wielding investor who's looking for quick ways to make money, the quick buck.
Right.
So, that's sort of where we are at this edge right now, which is, you know, the edge of the top of the market, and markets continue to test. But you also interestingly pointed out that since the Trump administration, since the new administration was, a done deal, markets have gone sideways compared to
U.S. markets have gone sideways.
Yeah, compared to Europe and
US
China,
every other developed market, and China and EM.
Yeah.
The U.S. is lagging virtually everything else you would want to invest in a normal portfolio, right? The best call you could have made on the day of the election was to sell all of your U.S. equities and buy China. Who would I like? I wouldn't have told you that in September, October.
Dave Tepper. Right?
But it turns out that's actually been the correct trade, is to actually counter tariff invest, right? Counter chaos invest. I don't know very many people that got that call right.
Dave Tepper, right? David Tepper.
Yeah. And honestly, the folks who were making that call back then, they didn't sound serious, right? Because everybody knew what was going to happen when Trump came in, except that we didn't expect the level of sort of stumbling incompetence that's gone on. And the vigor with which, frankly, everybody else in the world has been able to figure out how they want to position against us, right? That's been, I think, really the tragic and interesting thing. But that split in the market, I think it's reasonable to ask, is this the same as it always is, right? Like, did we have this exact same thing in 2000 and, 1992 and through all of these big up years we've had where you get sort of a lot of retail froth? Yeah, I suppose there's a little Greenspanian irrational exuberance we could talk about in retail. But by the same token, where's that money going to go? I always have that question in my mind, right? So if all this retail money, spooks because we had a down 4% day or something like that today, where does that money go? Does it just go back into cash balances? I think that's really unlikely. I think once this money is sitting in a Robinhood account or sitting in a Schwab account, it's pretty unlikely that that money goes to pay off a credit card debt, what's left of it after you've made a bad mistake. So I do think every time we have these bubbles, we train a whole new generation of long-term investors. Yeah, some folks will get flushed out at the top because they do the crazy stuff right at the wrong time. But inevitably, what I've seen over the years is, whether it was 2000, whether it was coming out of the GFC, this new batch of investors, a bunch of them actually get either bitten by the investing bug and they want to learn more and they want to do it correctly and they want to be smart about it, or they made a little bit of money, they understand the principles, they understand they got way over their skis, and you know what? They call financial advisors. That's the pathway here, is right? You either get flushed out completely, you become a smart, self-directed investor, or you become an advised investor. There really aren't any other paths. And I think we underestimate how many of these people stick around once these bubbles burst.
Go ahead. The large generations go through it, right? The baby boomers. And now, we've got Xers. But now we have the millennials coming into this. They're some investing years. And they've been gamified to a great degree in their existence. And then, investment firms. And I'm not sure who it's a classic chicken and egg, right? Because the investing companies, in order to sell product, have to make that product Amazonified, if you will.
They got to make it sexy. They got to sell it. I guess
it's not even making it sexy. Just make it not unsexy. Right. It's got to be like the things you do elsewhere, or it's weird. Right. Millennial generation. Yeah. My kids don't want to pick up the phone. Picking up the phone and calling someone is like a spooky, weird thing. No, honey, you have to call your doctor if they don't respond.
Which is also a superpower. They don't realize that. But that's
It's definitely a yin and a yang to that. So there's a generation that's coming into its investing life. Go ahead.
But I was going to say, but to your point, there are plenty of examples of firms out there who have built, say, new apps, new interfaces, new ways of doing this, but don't necessarily go down the raw financial nihilism end. I mean, the boom in robo-advisors, which I know we don't talk about robo-advisors anymore, even though they now have trillions of dollars across all of them, and everybody calls them failures while they're cashing checks. that whole market was largely built on the back of, hey, we're going to take your big complicated investing world and we're going to put it on your phone. And you're going to be able to look at it and say, nope, you still have $27,000. Oh, look, it's up $400 yesterday. Oh, look, you put a little bit more money in. Here's your little gold star, right? It's all based on that. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. So those are the white hats.
Nuggets Bitcoin.
Yeah. Those are the white hats, right? Vanguard's still a white hat and improving its technology. You've got, the companies like Betterment in the world who are doing a good job of, you know, here's your allocation. It is long term. Don't fall for the speculation stuff. So you're right. Let's not get too nihilistic because there are signs of actual good stewardship at low cost with lots of education around that. So it's not all bad to say, but we're at that point in the market where you do get a little frothiness and a little bit of
I like to think about this as like you remember chia pets? Are we all old enough to remember?
Oh yeah,
you put the little seeds on, it grows the hair. I like to think chia. That markets, particularly retail markets, are like chia pets, and that every once in a while they get a little wild and crazy. You just go shave them back down, and so what's going to happen is all this retail stuff, the worst of it, the most levered, the stuff that's most likely to blow up in a day, that'll all just get shaved off like the hair on a chia pet. And what's left are those strong roots that are going to keep growing. And those can be products that launch this year. It's not like every product that's coming out is garbage. But the worst of it will get shaved off. And the stuff that actually has value will get stronger and have deeper roots. And that's what will grow back. And those investors will just move into those kinds of products. So I actually think if you're an ETF issuer right now, or if you're a financial advisor sort of trying to figure out your positioning here, I think being there to catch all of this is actually a really reasonable strategy, right? Don't play in the froth. Be there with the rational answers when all this stuff falls apart.
It's a great comment, Dave. I will say, in my experience as an advisor going back many years, I recall, starting the business in sort of 1990, have been through, a couple of rookie training programs along the way. I remember in 2000, watching the advisor classes come through the training programs at the firms in Canada. It was very difficult in 98 and 99 and 2000 for those vintages of those advisors to actually build businesses. It was the most difficult time because if you weren't somehow addressing the froth, it was really hard to get client buy-in to say, hey, invest this way.
Yeah.
Invest with a value tilt. Right. Let's not be like Warren Buffett underperformed the S&P by 85% at one point in that period. And he's not a dumb investor. It just was that period of time. And so that type of thoughtful long-term planning was out of fashion. And it made it very difficult for those advisors to hear. So I agree. I think we should recognize that and provide the advisors who are on that path the confidence and a little bit extra, hey, stick with that path. Well, because over a 20-year career, that's going to work. And try as hard as you can not to engage in the speculative froth. And some clients will have to have it. So maybe behaviorally, it's give them a little, not too much. Just give them a little to satiate it, but keep the vast majority of the portfolio in those long-term, well-diversified portfolios where you're adding on a regular basis. And it's going to be a little harder right now to get those people on board.
Totally agree.
And it's hard to say to a client, like, hold on, right? It's hard. Like, I think, Dave, I think what I got from your comment from the, your latest post was that the attention is going there. That's where if you're talking about attention economy, and because, this generation that we're now talking about right now is spending a lot of time on their phones and subject to a lot of, TikTok and Instagram and advertising, that is designed to appeal to them, gambling apps and speculative ETFs side by side in the same space. I felt like reading, that your concern was that they're getting all the attention.
Yeah, right? I think
the
there
is some the, real the fad.
Yeah, and I think there are network effects to this stuff,
right? Yeah.
Where people see their friends doing a thing and they want to be doing it with them, and then that becomes the normal thing to do. I guess the reasons I'm not totally, you know, dragging my tongue in the sand on this stuff is, if you look at where the flows are actually going, if you look where the real money is going globally, not just in the U.S., it's still going in mostly the right places. There's a lot of froth. Like, if you look at the product launch schedule, it's almost all black hat stuff.
Right.
But if you look at where the real money is going in month after month after month, that hasn't changed. I mean, VOO and SPY in the U.S. are in the middle of this massive battle to see which can be the first bajillion fund, right? I mean, that's good, right? Those are appropriate investments for most people. So the bulk of the money is still going in the right places. All the noise is about all the crazy stuff. To your point, that's where the attention is on all this crazy stuff. I actually kind of hope that the sort of sideways market, the couple of rough days we've had here lately, and look, there'll be some more rough days. That's kind of exactly what we need to shovel some of this product off the table, right? We in 3 days, the double leverage MicroStrategy products all lost 50%. That's got to shake a few people out of those products. That's a good thing. So I'd prefer that. Like, I'd prefer a really frustrating market for a quarter or two that changes the tone, as opposed to a here's 25% crash for you. So I think this resolves pretty well. And to your point, Mike, yeah, it's real tough to build a new business and get new clients when the market's up 25% every year and the crazy stuff's up 100. I think in a sideways market where people are looking at like complicated tax bills they don't understand because, wait, I lost money. How do I owe money? That kind of thing. That's what gives people a hook to get to an advisor.
Yeah, right. And as we talk about, since the election, the U.S. sort of underperforming, it really hasn't shaken the confidence of investors in the S&P 500 that I've seen at all. And I'm not, you know, again, right, it's not, but you've got this recency bias of the performance that has come from it, right? Every dip has been bought for a decade and has not resulted in not just a 2020 type short correction and rebound, but a more 2000 like down 10, down 8, down 12 for 3 years where there was no rebound, right? And those types of longer drawn out affairs tend to flush the short termers out and kind of get, you know, back to who's actually investing for the longer term and can actually handle a few years of you know, downward pressure, watching that portfolio not go down and then come back up, but go down, and then the next year go down again, and then the next year go down again.
I mean, this is one of those great things you're going to play back to me in 6 months and then I'll never work again, but I honestly don't think that we will have three back-to-back down years in my lifetime. I think the flow dynamics of markets and the lack of alternative make it inconceivable to me that we're going to have sustained bear equity markets on a dollar basis. Like, I just can't see it. There's too much flow that has to go somewhere. And you know, to imagine that people will stop allocating to the S&P 500, you have to imagine their payroll goes somewhere else. And I'm one of those people who believes the sort of consistent drumbeat of passive flows into the market has this buy the BTFD issue, right? Which is, there is always a buyer for the next dip, right? And they may be a mechanical buyer, or they may be an enthusiastic buyer, but there is always a buyer for the next dip. That is not true on the sell side. There is not always a seller for the next pop, right? There are some, but there's no mechanical seller there except maybe some vol control funds, right?
Yeah.
It's just going to path that way. So I really think that we are in a world where I think the financial nihilism products and the black hat stuff will blow up because volatility will eventually kill them. I think over any reasonable definition of long term, like more than a year, the chips are so stacked in favor of American corporate statehood. How do you bet against Palantir here? How do you bet against Nvidia? It seems impossible to me that these stocks lose foundational value in a world where they're going to capture the bulk of the money that we're supposedly not spending.
And the valuations do, I think, play some role in that. Initial conditions on valuations, like Palantir is an example, NVIDIA, those are getting to some lofty value with Palantir in particular.
But yeah. I'm just saying, I don't think any of them are getting MySpace, right?
They're right.
Becoming endemic to the government. They're going to be like buying Lockheed Martin Marietta in 1965.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, okay, maybe they're shitty businesses once in a while, pardon my French, but you're not going to bet against the military industrial complex in the Cold War. I wouldn't be investing against the corpo state in the coming 10 years.
Where does that take us then? So we don't want to bet against it, but there could be possible areas of outperformance. So you could see rotation. So
absolutely. And
valuations in China, for example.
A place I'd love your thoughts, because I have not given this much thought, is my thesis about what's going on in terms of corporate statehood and our cyberpunk future would skew very heavily towards the mega caps, right? The folks with the most influence in Washington, the ones most likely to capture federal contracting, and probably less on the small business side. That's a weak conviction. But I'd love to get your thoughts, because you probably think about this more than I do. Do you feel like anything you're seeing would give you a strong lean towards growth versus value, large cap versus small cap? You know, the traditional things we think about inside the equity markets. I don't really have a strong view there.
Yeah, it's tough. The recursive nature of the flows is absolutely something that is a perplexing issue, especially when you've got that large market capitalization weight getting those flows, and not just in the U.S., right? Global markets are now 60 plus percent U.S. So somebody who's investing in a global portfolio. And so you're investing in a global fund in France. 65% of what you do is going to the U.S. stocks. You're in Japan and you're doing that. Again, global flows, if they're going to be market cap and passive is going to continue to be adopted, well, you've got global flows now coming into those mega caps at those allocations. So it is a very good argument. I wonder if there's enough active flows to tilt that a bit, where we do start to recognize the valuations and the longer term implications of valuations. Bonds versus stocks is an example. Vanguard put out a piece within the last month talking about, from where we are today, historically, stocks do zero, and bonds are set up to actually have a nice positive return.
Right,
they have a good real return. So institutions are going to be rebalancing to some degree in that. You don't get zero for cash anymore. Bonds maybe become an interesting investment, as long as the you don't get sort of the bond vigilante type situation where the U.S. has too much debt that is now a worry. So I think the valuation side of things could create an interesting opportunity for rotation. Hopefully that's the case, and hopefully we get away from the super concentration. But it's so hard to actually think about what's the thing that causes that.
Yeah.
Like, how does that actually happen? And obviously value investors have been beating that drum for a long, long time now.
Most of my adult life.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, if you're not in an index, if you're a company that's not in an index, that's a significant reduction in the capital that you receive, whether it's the multiple on your stock or the what amount you pay on your debt, and so on. So it's a tough problem.
The huge challenge to me, like, I agree, there should be these opportunities, right? I can see, like, yes, we should have these corrections in some of these super high-flying mega caps. Theoretically, that should benefit small cap value, some combination in that corner. The timing that has always been impossible. And B, like, there are managers out there doing this extraordinarily well, and nobody cares. I've talked to two sort of, you would know the names, but I want to put anybody on a spot, but boutique, active, small mid-cap stock selector managers, like the 90s called, they'd like their people back. To both of the ones that I looked at had 10-year track records where every single public fund they ran had beaten its benchmark. And they weren't like weird Spiva sandbag benchmarks. They were like legit, oh no, you stayed completely inside your mid-cap value bucket and you beat mid-cap value by 2% for 10 years. Nobody cares. They're all in net withdrawals, right? These strategies are so out of favor that even beating the market doesn't matter. I don't know how you overcome that. Like, that to me is just an error.
Yeah, and we are seeing, you know, it's funny. If you look at sort of equal weight S&P or equal weight NASDAQ versus the market cap weighted versions over the last month or two, we're seeing the equal weight outperform. So we are seeing broadening a little bit, but we've seen it before. And every time it's been fleeting.
It lasts for 3 months.
Yeah, it lasts for about as long as it's happened right now.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I don't think these are gameable. Like, I'm not smart enough to time these things and say now is when, and there's a whole industry of people. I mean, you guys had Doomberg on a while ago, like, make his calls on this stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about in terms of timing the market. I think for most advisors and investors, the answer is going to be a very boring, keep your broad global multi-asset class diversification portfolio and rebalance it on a regular basis. Like, I mean, that's, which is the most boring advice anybody's ever given on a podcast, but it's probably the right answer for most investors.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to the, to some degree, the idea of, and this is going to be, to some degree, a bit dangerous, but I'm going to say it anyway. The idea of creating wealth often comes from being focused, concentrated, using leverage, and surviving. There's a huge survivorship bias to that. Think of the guy who starts that company. We were talking at the beginning about investors who have an event and they've had a company and they've sold it in some way, shape, or form. Well, how did that happen? Well, they started a tire company or machining something somewhere in, you know, industrial North America. And, you know, maybe it was handed down by the father to the son and eventually gets to a point where it's taken out by somebody. But it was, you know, responding, surviving all the market fluctuations and the vagaries of recessions and whatnot. Very focused business, using probably leverage. There's probably loans and borrowing to that business when things got tough. The person who owned it put money in, mortgaged their house, got money from other people, survived, got through. And then all of a sudden they have this huge nest egg. And so, one, creating wealth is very different than preserving wealth. That's one thing. But I'm not sure people have the technical skills to do that in public markets that are very efficient, right? To use sort of leverage and saying to be concentrated. And, you know, we've all sort of heard the success stories of the guy who owned Tesla from $10 or Palantir. So that's harder to do in the investing world than it is to do in the business world. Maybe it's not harder. I don't know what's harder. Both are hard. But then when you get into the preservation of wealth in the longer term, it's not using, you know, concentrated bets. You can use leverage, but that leverage should be non-correlated leverage for non-correlated strategies. You need stack or add to in order to lower the volatility of the portfolio so that you can survive the drawdowns. Because nobody quits at the peak. They always quit at the drawdown bottom when they first realize
product on this. Like, I'm not going to talk your book on this, but, you know, in the white hat category of product that has had some traction, have been products doing exactly what you're talking about. This sort of prudent use of derivatives, prudent use of leverage to manage risk, to manage patterns of returns, to increase your survivability. That gets lumped in with a lot of this black hat stuff, but it's clearly not. I know a lot of investors who are either using, you know, the sort of intentional leverage type products that I know Resolve is involved with, or whether it's, you know, buffered products, of which there's a bazillion versions. I mean, even BlackRock's getting into that game now. And look, there's good buffered product and there's bad buffered product. It's 100%. Definitely something you've got to look under the hood. But, you know, there are places where it might make a lot of sense. Like, if you were going to invest in China tech right now and you could get, you know, your upside capped at 15% to have zero downside, I would take that bet with China up 40% in the last 6 months, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to make that allocation to China, but if I was going to, that's the product I would use. So there are products here that are, I think, smart and intentional and risk management oriented. And those are the ones that advisors should actually be learning how to use, actually learning how they work, know how to talk to their clients about them. If they're coming from the same firm that's selling you triple leverage Bitcoin income, they don't have the white hat on, right? Like they may have a product that you could use, and that's fine, but recognize what they're actually doing.
Right. And that's not a way to use concentrated levered focus,
right?
A long term this is the point I don't want to confuse, right? You had this longer term business that kind of got this net big lump. So when you're working and saving for this long term goal of retirement, or what, however that manifests for you, it really is, that's not your crazy money. That is your diversified, preserve wealth, longer term money, and you're employing your skills and labor into the world in order to create an income, save some of that income, and hopefully that career activity provides lots of extra income for you to save and be responsible with. I want to differentiate those two areas, as you say, because I don't want someone saying, well, yeah, you just go concentrate a triple levered Bitcoin. And again, like an asset that has volatility that's 30 to 70%, like factually, categorically, you're going to have a moment where you're wiped out. Right, it's gambler's ruin. Right,
pennies in front of a steamroller.
Yeah, you can't hold those things and say, well, I'm just going to hold these for eternity with leverage at that. You know, a 10% downside requires 11% return to get back to even. Like, there's an asymmetry to losses versus gains in a portfolio that is hard to overcome, and then you throw leverage on these highly volatile assets. We've seen it in the vol market, right? We saw vol markets get eviscerated by Volmageddon.
Right.
That's the type of thing we're looking at here when you double, triple lever micro strategies, right? It will end up in a day where a stock can be down 30% in a day. And if you've double levered it, you got 12 cents.
Yeah. The thing is, like, we've been through, in my career in the ETF industry, we've been through a handful of what I would call systemic breaks. Places where we figured out where the cracks were in the system. Flash crash in 2010 is the big obvious one. We changed a bunch of rules, haven't had a flash crash since. Stuff about how we were going to open and close illiquid bonds. Okay, we fixed some of that. Now we haven't had any of those problems, right? Orange County, debt. We haven't had any of those problems. So we patched the ETF ecosystem as we've gone. The thing that we've now introduced that we have not tested is all of this leverage coming at through the almost exclusively through the options market is where that leverage is really coming from on single securities, which we all know single securities have all sorts of issues of their own in terms of how they're going to get stopped, how they're going to get traded, how they're going to get manipulated. I hate to be one of these people who's like, I have concerns, but I'm not going to tell you how to fix it. But I have concerns about the amount of leverage and particularly the amount of vega, the amount of volatility being bought and warehoused in the options market, given that the options clearing corporation's like emergency fund is like $200 million or something like that, which sounds like a lot of money until you realize the trillions of dollars of notional exposure that is being held against these things, supposedly all completely balanced and cleared with two-sided trades. I understand why there should not be a problem, and I have no concerns about the OCC being an effective version of what they do. I know people there. I have no reason to think they're doing anything but the best possible job. But structurally, we've moved all of this vol exposure and leverage exclusively into options dealers in Chicago, effectively. That makes me somewhat concerned the next time we have, I don't know, XYZ stock gets investigated for fraud, lied about their quarterly returns. I don't know. We don't know what horrible thing is going to happen that causes some stock to delist or suspend 3 days of trading or whatever. And those hiccups, those are where we end up finding those cracks in the system. So all that stuff makes me super nervous.
Yeah, I often think of what John Kenneth Galbraith, short history of euphoria in markets. And, I'm actually going to give that book a reread. I think it's time to read that book again. And I recall some of the quotes in it, which I'll totally bastardize. But, on whose fault is it, right? Investors are having this sort of really speculative seeking behavior that is coming with the positive returns in the market, especially single stocks doing so well in an AI boom or whatever the boom is, autonomous driving and so on. And, you know, the firms look at each other and they say, well, the music's playing. I know there's, you know, we're playing musical chairs.
Yeah.
And you kind of got to dance if you're looked at every quarter. And it's a very unique company, like a Vanguard over the last 50 years, who's decided to dance to their own beat and own drum and pound a, you know, do something that's a little bit more white hat through the ups and downs of it all. But it's a really rough patch if you're in the C-suite. And what are you going to do? You're just going to underperform, not get your stock options?
I get it. And I'm not sitting here casting personal aspersions on anybody who works for one of these companies that is, you know, out there marketing and trading one of these products. People got to eat. People have to build generational wealth for their own families. I understand that. I'm not telling people to go quit their job at Direction and ProShares or anything like that. I have very good friends who work at many of these firms that I will firmly put a black hat on. But that doesn't mean that they still can't go to that job every day, erring on the side of disclosure, erring on the side of, well, is this actually good for the person who's buying this on the other side? To your point, who to blame? I'm not blaming the ETF industry for filling what is clearly an investor need. Once we saw that somebody was going to buy 2x Tesla in an ETF, of course, I mean, I said this a year and a half ago, I was like, we're going to end up with 3 versions of every stock in the S&P 500 in both directions. That's 3,000 securities. Okay, like, get ready for it. We'd have 3,000 single stock levered ETFs minimum. That's going to be the market. Okay, well, most of those products are just going to be trading vehicles. We people who are a little more rational in the industry have to understand them, have to understand how they work. But I'm not saying it's evil, and I'm not saying that these are being foisted on an unknowing population of people who need to be protected. I'm not arguing for that. I'm not saying we should ban Robinhood or we should ban any of these products, but we should recognize that we are now in a world where, you know, you are walking through the supermarket, and in that supermarket, there is the single worst can of tuna you can buy and the single best can of tuna you can buy. And one of them might make you very sad the next morning.
You know, I can't help thinking, like, when you look at, you know, the white hat, black hat argument, like, the white hat companies can go on, you know, doing what they do and march to the beat of their own drummer. But what happens, you know, in fulfilling the black hat side, you know, companies are creating products that are fulfilling this gambling, this speculative mania that's happening, that has happened throughout, you know, different periods in history. And now they're fulfilling the current one. What happens if, like, so everybody's on their own island. You got the white hat folks on one island and the black hat folks on the other. What happens, like, they're very interconnected still, even if they think they're on separate islands. What happens when the black hat stuff fails?
Yeah.
When the dominoes start to drop because the black hat stuff failed. Like, you just mentioned, for example, like, there's only $200 million in a fund that is supposed to cover up to trillions of dollars worth of trades, potentially. I mean,
you have to imagine the whole market goes bankrupt in one day. I mean, there's always winners and losers on a
league, right? It's balanced, levered. So that 200 million is the excess. But
we all rely on these infrastructure pieces.
But if
they break,
if they
break, it's bad for everybody. I think,
they're being broken, right? I mean, like, the systems. A lot of this, like, if you look at the new administration and what they're doing and DOGE and all that stuff, they're systematically going about dismantling the infrastructure that oversees this stuff, right? So there's a real danger that the regulatory stuff, even just like the basic regulation, disclosure, transparency, all those things are being undermined by these, you know, firings, these mass firings that are happening everywhere.
I'm, for what it's worth, I'm less worried about the sort of the dogification of financial infrastructure. I understand why people are concerned about it. By all means, lose your mind if you want to, but we haven't actually seen them go in and say, we're going to fire all of these people who do audits at the Division of Investment Management. If we start seeing that kind of targeted stuff inside financial regulators, which we've seen a little bit of at the Fed, there's inklings of it, then I think we can be concerned. I think they're smart enough. And I think if you look at the people in financial positions in the cabinet, they're the only sane ones. Whether I agree with their policies or not, they're all clearly qualified to be, like, you know, Hester Peirce is obviously the correct right. person to be focused on crypto at the SEC. There's nothing insane going on there yet. So I'm not so worried about, like, we fire all the ATC folks and then all the planes crash in financial markets. I'm much more concerned about we throw all this leverage into places we don't understand right. it, and then something breaks. And as you point out, we all rely on the infrastructure regardless of what breaks. So if it's Citadel has a giant problem and Citadel goes down for 3 days, well, that's terrible for everybody. No matter how much you hate Citadel, them gapping out of the market would be chaotic and bad, and trades would get broken, et cetera. Just like when Lehman went under, you could snicker all you wanted if you didn't like Lehman, but it wasn't great for anybody when Lehman went under, right? It just wasn't. So those things are real. Those are the kinds of things that could taint the overall market. I'm less worried about that. I think that whatever breaks here is going to be probably fairly narrow and fairly violent, just like we saw with Volmageddon.
Right. And I guess that a big point here is that we are seeing the signs that come along with markets evolution from, you know, the bear market bottom to the, I don't even want to call it a top, but the exuberance that happens.
The frothiness.
Yeah. And, you know, in every case, it's always some financial innovation in one form or another. 2008 had its alphabet soup of that sort of
portfolio
stuff.
Portfolio insurance. You know.
Yeah. It portfolio insurance of 87, right? The creation of these relationships and supposedly all secured by some real assets somewhere. And so you're seeing that. And I think it behooves us to remember that in the aftermath of speculation, there's lots of self-denial. If we look back at 08 or 2000, those responsible for it are rarely blamed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and right? I don't think
they certainly don't blame themselves. The investor doesn't blame themselves. Often they're not brought to any kind of consequence, to be fair.
No, they're very rarely do these things result in some sort of Hollywood satisfying ending where so-and-so gets perp walked down the street because they're the ones that caused you to lose your house. Like, it rarely works that way. No, these things sort of dribble out, and then there's a giant socialization of all the losses and risks when, like, we pass some, you know, TARP version 73 or something like that. Yep. Like, we know how it ends up because Wall Street always has to get bailed out. Even more so, like, again, remember, we are now working in a completely captive corporate state in the United States, which means if something is bad for the top 50 stocks in the S&P 500, it will not be allowed to happen for very long. Right. It simply will be stopped by, like, they'll close the market. They'll make, you know, a sovereign wealth fund that invests in the top 50 stocks. They'll find a way. So I don't think you can bet against this. I think as a positioning statement, all we can guarantee is something gonna break and we don't know what it is, and it will probably be fairly contained, and you definitely can't time it.
Yeah.
Which is really unhelpful, I understand.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does sort of suggest that you come back to the sort of the tried and true longer term investing approach, adding on a regular basis, not getting out there on the risk spectrum too far when you're emboldened to do so by, you know, your own recency bias, overconfidence, and the fact that you're, you know, some of your friends might be doing it, and you know, being left out is also very emotionally painful.
Yeah, I think the one takeaway I did have from these two pieces that I wrote last week, which were not about asset class positioning or what you should or shouldn't do in the markets, the thing I came away with is actual advice to advisors who I've actually talked to about this specific topic in the last month or two a lot, is know why you are with all of your partners. And I use the word partners intentionally, because whether that's the firm that you're hanging your license underneath, but you're kind of independent, how much do you trust that those folks are actually looking out for you, not for their bottom line? Like, and I'm talking about, like, handshakes, face-to-face, person-to-person. I know Janet. Janet wouldn't screw me over. That kind of trust, I think, is going to become much more important. I think we've gotten very used to the idea that you can read about something, find it on the internet, fill out your ACH numbers, and make a transaction without ever having talked to a human being or knowing who you're interacting with. I think those days are gone. And I think if you rely on those very disintermediated relationships because the rule of law is going to save you if something goes wrong, you are going to be badly surprised.
So due diligence, there's,
yeah.
Do your due diligence.
Yeah. I think what he's saying goes beyond due diligence,
yeah,
to the point where you're actually having a physical human interaction connection where you look in the eye. But I'm speaking for you, Dave.
That's exactly what I mean. And look, I understand that's not every transaction. Like, I don't know somebody at OpenAI because I spent $20 a month to use their service. But, you know, if I'm an advisor and I've got a $200 million book of business and I have a core equity partner and I have to decide whether that's BMO or BlackRock or whoever, okay, well, I understand those are big firms and they're probably not going to screw over all of their clients. But when my client has a custodial problem with a transfer, do I believe they're actually looking out for my best interest? So things like, you talk about Vanguard being a white hat. I generally agree in terms of product launch. But if you're an advisor who has problems, we've all heard the nightmares about Vanguard customer service as an advisor. I mean, I'm not breaking any news here, right?
Yeah.
So like, that's a really important part of your job as an advisor. They may have white hat product, but if you can't count on them to be on the phone with you when $1 million wire transfer gets lost, then they're not a white hat.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
Interesting.
Debbie Downer.
Oh, no, I don't think any of that's Debbie Downer. I think really all of that is an opportunity to add value, right? So the client, you know, doesn't, when the $1 million wire goes missing, that's a top priority for the client that you're representing.
Yeah, and look,
obviously.
I mean, Y'all know advisors. We all get these horror stories, right? We all know the stuff that goes wrong in the plumbing of this business on an everyday basis for no fault of anybody, except that's how the systems work.
Yeah.
Right? You know, this trust document didn't get signed, whatever.
You know, Alan Greenspan, when he was once a disciple of Ayn Rand, wrote a, you've probably read it if you've read the New Collectivism anthology of essays, but in there is Alan Greenspan's essay on antitrust. And one of the things he writes about is the idea that, you know, if you have an agency of government, for example, setting a minimum standard, and I think the example was electrical standards. Like, his point was that there's no incentive for an exceptional electrician to do better work than the minimum standard that's being upheld for everyone else,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, sure, you might have customers who might be willing to pay you a significant premium for your expert handiwork, but you're competitively going to be crippled if you try to do that, because every other electrician is doing the minimum standard of work while you're out there trying to say, I'm really special and I can charge more, right? And, you know, we're talking about, you know, how do these things happen? Who's to blame when things go wrong or when things aren't good? I'm reminded of the story of, you know, how did all of our manufacturing end up in industrial towns in China? How did that happen? Like, and this is the, you know, this is the political rant, which is like, all our jobs are gone. You know, we've given all of our manufacturing jobs to China and to other third world or emerging countries over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, who's to blame? The reality is that when, you know, companies started to make those moves to go to China, it was to be competitive. And then as soon as company A sets up shop in China and they can make their goods for 20% of the cost, how does company B that's still, you know, in Iowa or you know, in a Rust Belt supposed to compete with that unless they do exactly the same thing, right?
Yeah, no, there is a tragedy of the commons here that it's absolutely part and parcel of this. And, until recently lived in a pretty global free trade world, which meant that those kinds of labor imbalances were going to work themselves out one way or the other, either in terms of the wages people were willing to accept in North America or in terms of the quality of life we were willing to have in North America, one or the other, right? So, you know, we funded China's growth. That's what we did. By giving them things to do with their excess capacity, we gave them an opportunity for productivity. So I have a hard time blaming anybody on that, because I don't think a lot of Americans were volunteering to go leave college and train for manufacturing jobs either. Right. So I think it's very much it's not politicians, it's not businesses, it's not workers, it's all of the above. Right. That's the way we moved things. So I don't know whether we can swing the pendulum back, but we'll see, I guess.
Well, I think
the blame game,
the markets maybe swing the pendulum back, like just taking your electrician example.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm an electrician who does excellent work and my work is better than everybody else's. But there's a minimum standard, and if I do the better work, my profit margin suffers.
Yeah.
Right? So somewhat like an advisor who is suggesting to someone, here's a portfolio, you know, it's low cost, here's what it's done. And then the next guy comes in with his shiny new portfolio, right? We all know the kind of the trick that advisors play. Well, this is my model portfolio, which, by the way, is a new model portfolio that takes into account, you know, all the stuff that's happened over the last few years. Your portfolio is a guy who actually did things live and kept you on track and didn't let you get into speculative fervor. And at these speculative moments, those people who were endeavoring in those may have better returns than you at the moment. Will they keep that money in the longer term? Right. And so it's a really hard problem when you're an advisor trying to do the right thing. It's like almost a competitive disadvantage at times like this.
I hear you, but I mean, I've also talked to a lot of advisors in the last couple months who told me somewhat the opposite, which is, look, you know, my highest selling point is I haven't changed my asset allocation because of the last 6 weeks of what's going on. And they've trained their clients that part of the reason they're with that advisor is because, no, I'm not going to call my advisor every 3 months saying, why are we behind Bob's cocktail party portfolio by 3%? Yep. For sure, if what you're selling to your clients is your portfolio management and asset allocation expertise, you're screwed. I think that's a terrible way to build an advisor business right now. I don't think that that's a sustainable long-term moat. If you're that good at that, you should be running a hedge fund. I think the moat most advisors have is their actual relationships with their clients. And again, that's the kind of trust that I think survives the coming chaos.
And we're also fighting a certain amount of financial amnesia as you progress into markets that have not had corrections. Although, you know, it's shockingly short, the memory. Like 2022 was a rough year.
It is.
2020 had its challenges. The thing is, they've snapped back with relative short-term, you know, those have been short-term pain rather than a 1970s type scenario
and 2021 was such outlier years because of the pandemic, right? So I think
absolutely.
We have memory hold the pandemic in a lot of ways that are very interesting and weird as a culture, but we just swept financial learning along with all the other learning that we've decided to forget about from the pandemic, right? So honestly, when I talk to folks and they like get worried about stuff, nobody mentions anything except the GFC or 2000. It's either the end of the dot-com boom or it's the GFC. Those are the only two big market disruptions anybody talks about long-term, neither one of which I feel is particularly relevant for the now.
Right. Where it's relevant, I think, for the collective investor memory is that it does pinpoint bad or poor returns can happen. And they can happen in either longer or deeper ways than you might have ever expected prior to them happening. And that's the general learning you get if you had money at risk during those periods. What you've learned since 2008 is buy the dip, right? Like that's just worked in a way that, well, I'll buy the dip and next year I'll be fine. And 1 year is enough time I can stick it out. But when the dip is 20 and next year's down 10, I think that's kind of the thing you might need at some point in order to have a collective memory of that.
Battle of psychology. I mean, Mike, I think you're right on it. I think it's this battle of psychology between, whether or not that buy the dip mentality, always keep buying, or as Nick Crowley's book says, right? That is a real thing in sort of millennial investors, just always keep buying. to the extent they really believe that, it's totally conceivable to me that we actually have a fairly miserable economy for 2 years and the market goes up 20% a year for the next 2 years. Not for any reason, not because earnings are going up or these companies are somehow performing better than we expect, but simply because capital is going to say that is where it needs to be. And so we're just going to get used to a world where the median PE in the S&P 500 is 30, right?
Yep.
I think we're really headed for that.
Yeah. And you look at that period, you know, 65 to 82 and 82 to 90. In fact, the growth on the S&P for those two periods is the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The starting valuation 65 is different than the starting valuation 82, which accounts for the returns. But you wonder, yeah, to what extent, as you said, this could be pushed out for another decade. When we talk about market tops or the frothiness, like it doesn't mean it ends. It could go on for far longer than you can ever imagine. A lot of what I see in the comparisons to, hey, we're at an expensive market in the U.S., as expensive as 2000. Yeah, that NASDAQ was very expensive, but have you looked at Japan 1989? Because that's twice as expensive as the S&P got. So things can get frothy.
Well, I also just...
We're just going to
have to... has to be in the context of what else is going on, and like the regulatory and legal regime for capitalism is just completely different than it was in the 90s, right? I mean, I don't think we can make apples to apples comparisons and say like the natural PE for the S&P should be XYZ, right? Or a natural interest rate should be XYZ. We should just burn those textbooks for fuel. They're useless right now.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really
you just don't know.
So that's so harsh. It's so art. and you know, if you do have that 20, 30 year time frame, you just keep dollar cost averaging in. You like you said,
that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, you just keep trucking along, do the thing that works in the longer term. Certainly challenging for advisors to keep that. Maybe not in all cases. There's a lot of good investors out there. And as we've seen, the flows into good passive portfolios, they're there. There's going to be an impact, as you say, and there'll be something that spreads, whether it's some MicroStrategy or some form of financial innovation and engineering will break. Hopefully it can be ring-fenced, right? And hopefully it can be handled in a way that's like that if you get something more systemic. Even those create, you know, experiences and more hardened investors for the long term.
Totally agree.
I don't know if you saw it yesterday. There was this moment on CNBC halftime with between Steve Weiss and Judge on the halftime show, Wapner. And
I like Judge reference. It's funny.
Judge. Yeah. Anyway, so there's this, they're sitting beside each other.
Yeah. Our generation. But we have people will not get that. Yeah.
Well, that's his nickname, right? But they're sitting beside each other. And Steve Weiss made a comment, you know, like, you know, that the market, it would be great if the market had a big shakeout. And I'm mixing up his words a little bit, but it would be great if there was, you know, a real shakeout in the market. And so, you know, Judge looks at him and he goes, oh, really? You think it would be great if there was a big shakeout in the market? That would be great. Right. That would be great for investors. And he goes, yeah, you know, it just escalated into this, you know, you shut up. You shut up.
Welcome to financial journalism.
Judge says to him, you know, maybe you should go and sit. Maybe you should switch positions with someone else on the panel. You know, I don't want you sitting next to me.
Yeah, financial journalism shouldn't be about cheerleading the market up. It should be about truth. But hey, what do I know?
I just thought it was like, you know, I kind of knew what Weiss was intimating, which is that shakeout. It's just what we've been talking about.
It would be healthy.
Yeah, it would be healthy. It would, you know, it would calm some of the FOMO down and reduce
the hair off the chia pet.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. But I guess, it just went sideways and you know, for those 3 or 4 minutes, it got pretty heated.
Well, you know,
love it.
All financial journalism is entertainment these days.
Love it.
Yeah, I want to come back and pull the string on something you said earlier on, Dave, which I think was, you know, the idea that there's a lot of financial innovation, a lot of change in regulation, and it'll be interesting to see if anyone gets held account for some of the stuff that they're doing. I'm bastardizing that. And I'm going to draw a parallel to 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, and the real estate market that ensued, all of the shenanigans that went on with financing of houses, with all of the banks and pseudo banks that were involved in, you know, not requiring any income to buy a property and so on, right? That lack of regulation and enforcement and the inevitable lack of consequences for many of those players, right? And I'm just like, it doesn't really seem different this time. It seems like it's moved into the industry of maybe ETFs and that sort of financial creation area. But how do you see the differences today versus that in that real estate context and its implications for markets? What you were saying earlier made me think of that and said, well, it kind of that's happened. Like there was this real loosening of regulation. Maybe you could just kind of work through that a little bit.
Here, well, so part of the reason I don't think anybody, let's start with the, will anybody ever be held accountable? I actually don't think that whatever breaks here is going to be the result of malfeasance by a party that you could drag in front of a hearing, right? I think what's going to break is, oh, we didn't understand ... We never thought that this desk would be hypothecating to that desk, which would then put it on the options more. Like, it's going to be one of those things. Like,
right.
You know, as a compliance person, you know very well how easily those things can slip through.
Housing never went down, right? That was because the not spirit.
I think that the whatever breaks part is probably going to be non-nefarious. I think the bigger question is, where do people start going way over the lines and doing really bad stuff? And I'm not naming names because I can't point. If I can point to somebody, I'd write an article about it and say, these people are bad. I think there are edge cases right now in the U.S. ETF industry, particularly around privates, which is probably where we're going to see some of that bad actor stuff, where it's like, all right, you're walking the tightrope of the line. Which side are you going to fall off on? But I don't think any of those things result in any kind of consequence unless enough people get hurt. I mean, even look at Madoff and things like that. Just outright, straight up frauds. Like, some justice was served, but do you really feel like the whole ecosystem around him was appropriately, you know, punished to never go forth and do this again? No, of course not. Same with like FTX, right? Okay, a couple people went under. Do you really think it was four people involved?
You blocked two or three or four people for the cares. A little theater, so everyone feels like following him.
Pardoned by Trump anyway. So, you know, I'm not even joking.
Wow.
So
I'd be interested to do that. That's going to be interesting.
So no, I don't think that there are ever going to be those kinds of consequences. I also think the breaks aren't going to be the really obvious stuff. And I think that the egregious sort of rule testing is going to happen in the private equity stuff. We're too early to call for a blow up there because we don't really have any products yet. Once one launches, I'll tell you when it will blow up. The one that State Street's trying to file with Apollo, you know, which is completely captive from the issuance of the private credit to the buying and the selling of the private credit to the fund and to the striking of the NAV for the value of the private credit that is only traded by Apollo. I mean, it's so ridiculously self-dealing all the way around the Venn diagram. Of course, something in there will blow up if there's a problem in private credit, right? If the U.S. economy actually does hiccup for more than a week and some of that private credit defaults, right, which is what you would expect, okay, how much of it ends up in the ETF? How many liquidations are there? It'll turn into Third Avenue all over again, except there won't be any underlying market. So we're headed for those, and there'll be plenty of bad actors to point to when those launch, but year to year, we'll come back. We can talk about that.
Right. Yeah, it's classic unknown unknowns.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right? If I knew, I mean, this is call it a black swan, call it whatever you want, but, you know, not sure yet because we haven't had the problem yet. We haven't done the patchwork. And that seems to be what it takes in the past for when these financial innovations cause these little unexpected consequences that no one was thinking of. Right. Yeah.
So like in a way, you've got that big sort of set of black swan events out there, which they're always out there. And it's easy to be a doomer and always be worrying about that. I actually think most of the black swan events are not hedgeable in the traditional financial sense, which is why I'm like, yeah, just go long. It's going to be a corpus state. Why would you bet against it? And then I think the more trust-oriented things, the things you actually should pay attention to, are much smaller. I think it's really things like, you know, who does your accounting work? Like those kinds of relationships are really going to be the ones where nothing big is going to blow up. It's not like your whole business is going to go under, but you're going to get some client who's audited, and it's going to get weirder because there's not going to be enough people on the other side of the table from the government. So you're going to have somebody really good on your side to figure that out. Those are the kinds of very narrow trust relationships that I think people underestimate how important they're going to be in the next couple of years.
Love it. Well, that all I think is quite bullish for the state of the advisor. Actually having a phone number that you could call someone, not just a bot on a website or a Discord server or whatever it is, but actually being able to interact with somebody. I think that's certainly where we see a lot of traction, where, some of the firms are more high tech, low touch. That can be frustrating at times when they're, you know, those call centers or bots or FAQs are highly overwhelmed with traffic, and we need answers because something different has occurred.
And that's the problem. It's the something different, right?
Yeah.
All the AI backend systems are great at showing you what you already know.
Yeah.
Terrible at dealing with a brand new thing and telling you what to do about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this draws our conversation about the importance and value of seeking good financial advisors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good custodial security as well.
Being
good custodial relationship. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's the one-on-one relationships are going to be the most important thing in the world. And that's the definition of the advisory business. Right.
Yeah.
So if I was smart enough, I'd go back and get my own CFP, but that ship sailed.
There is something you realize as you attack on a few years, you're like, okay, it takes this long to get that. And then how long am I going to exploit that?
Yeah, no, it's
like
20 years left. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about here.
I love it. Love it. Is there anything else that you've been working on? I think we've covered that pretty comprehensively. Is there anything else you're seeing out there that you want to talk about today?
No, what's that thing that you brought up in your email, Dave, about things breaking and, you know, and who's going to come?
Oh, the thing we expect the feds to do. Yeah, I mean, I, at the risk of being too doomer about this stuff, I think one of the things that I've learned from my own relationship with my own financial advisor is a good financial advisor doesn't just ask you about your portfolio. They ask you about a whole range of things that generally involve money, but they also get to know you and your family and the things that are important to you. It's been surprising to me already in the last year, not having an employer in the United States and just being self-employed and doing consulting work and stuff like that, how many things I took for granted that are provided by corporations in the United States. And the obvious ones are things like health insurance in the US, where, you know, the second you're off your corporate health insurance, you are screwed and you better figure it out really fast. That was a surprising example for me of watching the federal government fall apart in real time, because in Massachusetts, we're blessed enough to have universal health care. There are a couple steps you have to go through to get on it. So as soon as we got off the employer health care, we walked to the office and filled that in. And, you know, it's bureaucracy with miles of paperwork, blah, blah, blah. In the end, I ended up with free health care, because that's what you get in Massachusetts if you've been living here and paying taxes. But the way we got access to it 4 weeks ago when we had to re-sign up for 2025 was we went to an office in the nearest city. It was about a half hour away, sat in line for half an hour, talked to some nice young man who helped us figure out, like, oh, this is the system you have to fill the stuff. I'm pretty smart. I couldn't figure any of it out.
Yep.
It was like 40 or 50 different pages of paperwork to get into the system. Last week, all those people were fired. The whole office that we went to in Western rural Massachusetts, which whole job was to help people get their health insurance, that entire business was shut. That whole office was shut down. So a month ago, there was a service that the federal government was providing me to help me get access to health care, which I was entitled to on the taxes I paid. Now I would have to drive 2.5 hours to Boston to get that same exact service that I got before, and probably have to get an appointment months and months in advance to even do it. So just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen that these subtle erosions of things we don't even realize we rely on coming from the federal government, those are the things that are going to erode. As an advisor, I think the smart thing to be doing is cataloging that list in your head of like, okay, whether it's going to the Registry of Motor Vehicles to, you know, get my own personal car relicensed, or dealing with my high net worth family that forgot to deal with their passport renewal. And it used to be you could do that in 2 weeks if you paid the guy a bunch of money. Now you can't do it anymore because they closed those windows, which is another thing that actually happened. Wow. Like, those are real issues that are going to show up in advisors' laps in very subtle and strange ways. And again, it comes back to this issue of who do you trust to actually be fighting for you as those interfaces to the government get worse and less reliable. I think we know the answers. We know the answers from some Commonwealth countries. We know the answers from some dictatorships and oligarchies from the past, which is, there's going to emerge a set of private services that exist between you and the government, and they advocate for you on your behalf. We already know some of those things exist, things like visas and passports, family office services, a lot of stuff in that realm. I think we're going to see even more of that, right? We're going to end up with certain kinds of tax preparers that get access and certain kinds of tax preparers that don't.
It's wild.
This sounds like
cheerful, I know.
It's the Wild West.
I always marvel at the complexity with which some of the programs. You know, I'm a fairly well educated person, but I deal in the financial services business, and then you go to something like try to get your Medicare done in Massachusetts, and you're like, I'm familiar with forms. I really am.
Yep.
I Google high visa. I've had a fair bit of regulation, and I'm really struggling trying to figure this out. It would seem it should be easier.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Not sure why it isn't.
Well, to your point, Dave, you know, if someone asked you, you know, where did you go? And you didn't know that it was shut down, but you say, oh, I went to this place over here. And I said, you know, you should, they'll help you. You should go, right? You're giving somebody, you know, just friendly advice. You should go down there. And then, you know, a few days later, they come, you know, they you cross paths with them, and they say, you know, that thing you sent me to that you told me to go and see, they're gone. Like, where do I go now? Right? It's just, you know, like this whole, I feel like we've been, you know, we've had, like, it doesn't feel like it's been a month. It feels like it's been years already. Like, we've just had years and years of this stuff. Is every day something is changing. Every day, you know, there's new executive orders. Every day, some wonky set of, you know, edicts. Like, it reminds me of, you know, I mentioned Ayn Rand before. I'm a big fan, but it feels so much like, in many ways, it feels like the Atlas Shrugged world where, you know, arbitrary things are being ordered, new rules are being made.
I don't want to get too down the Randian rabbit hole.
No, I know.
But we're gonna learn a lot of those things in real time. Like, yep. I think that we're gonna figure a bunch of that stuff out. And, you know, the only question is going to be whether or not there's enough competence for them to actually implement everything they want to implement, right? And to what extent the American people are willing to just go backwards on a bunch of stuff. America's not real good at going backwards. We've tried to go backwards on stuff a lot.
Yep.
And it's very rarely worked very well. So, when they start coming after, like, gay marriage, which, you know, there's 9 states now putting forth anti-gay marriage bills in the U.S., like, we start going back to fighting the 90s all over again in terms of the AIDS crisis, which is where, you know, that's where I got, you know, polarized, was in the AIDS crisis. boy, there's going to be a lot of Gen Xers who are going to flip sides, I think, pretty quick if we start revisiting the AIDS crisis. I think that's probably a line. I think that's a line in the sand. I thought Roe v. Wade was going to be a line in the sand, but we'll see.
Now, I almost viewed it. It's the and when Atlas shrugged, but I wouldn't also forget about the Fountainhead.
The Fountainhead,
and Ellsworth Toohey, and sort of, you know, the manipulation of public opinion and polluting independent judgment, and, you know, kind of promoting mediocrity a little bit, that I feel has been a bit of what's going on for a long time now with you know, social media and the manipulation of social media and public opinion. And it's a strange world.
I mean, those were once, you know, Mike, those were once fantastic, idealistic stories, you know, that really, like, pushed things out to the edge so that you could discern, you know, one idea from another.
Sure, I get it.
We've come to that, you know, we've come to that polarity, haven't we? Like, we've got this polarization where half the country voted for Trump and the other half didn't, and it's all or nothing when you win. And but, you know, I agree with you, Dave. We're starting to see, you know, like, the extent to which the American public agrees or disagrees with these daily edicts that are coming out, you know, these executive orders, and you know, like, the Black and Hispanic community who voted for Trump are now, you know, wait a minute, you know, this is crazy what you're doing. Then now they're turning against one another. You know, when you see that kind of, like, you know, fomenting of chaos that's going on, even among his voters, even among the Trump voters, exactly. I mean, what you said is that, you know, to what extent do Americans want to go backwards? And you know, Donald Trump does not care.
No, nobody cares. Right? Because, so, like, that's the danger, is that there's nobody there. I genuinely believe there is nobody currently in the administration that cares about winning an election 4 years. Like, they do not care. They want to get done what they want to get done, and they're willing to just, whatever happens in the future happens in the future. Everything they're doing,
someone else will have to deal with it.
And so, like, none of the cabinet members here are trying to get a lifetime career in politics. They all have businesses. They're all billionaires, right? So, like, they don't need to win an election in 4 years. They need to change the world now the way they want to entrench whatever power they can. And then if the Democrats win later, they will have already won, because they will have gotten done the things they wanted to get done, whether that's, you know, embedding their AI systems into the, you know, fabric of government, or, you know, putting Starlink in charge of FAA. Like, those things will just happen. And yeah, they could lose all three parts of the government again, but they're really hard to undo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on that cheery note.
Yeah.
I feel like you should give me the little bird face, like Doomberg.
Yeah, there you go. Amazing.
Dave, well, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time. And
oh, well, thank you for the fun conversation. Next time we can just do an Ayn Randoff, and we can I'll take the other side of most of those arguments. I'm going to guarantee it.
It's funny, you know, I felt strikingly like that the last Trump term, you know, looking, this is surreal. This situation is sublime, what's happening here. You know, every day is chaotic. Now it's like a multiple of that. You know, now it's like times, it's 10x.
Never bet against America and our ability to go big.
Yeah.
You want chaos? Oh, we'll show you chaos.
Let's see how it all works out.
Mate.
It's wild. Love it.
Oh, dear. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you again, Dave. It's DaveNattig.com.
Just Nautic.com.
So Nautic.com, good Substack there for readers to get lots of education and insights along the way. And thank you for joining us.
Dave Nautic on every social media platform you could want to spend and waste.
There you go.
Love it.
Love it.
Thanks, Dave.